it's Mark Pack with the latest Nevermind the Bar chart. But this time, it's something completely different because I appeared on the excellent Spybrew podcast a little while back talking about my five favourite espionage novels. So, as a little variation from politics, of which I think we'll get more than enough this year, here it is, over to Shane and my choices.
Do you love spy books, movies, and TV? Then the Spybrary podcast is for you. Since 2017, host Shane Whaley and Spybrary field agents around the world dispatch reviews and interviews with authors, historians, and fellow spy fans. We discuss everything from John le Carré, Len Dayton, Paul Vidich, Graham Greene, Mick Herron, Charles Cumming, Ben McIntyre, and many more. Spybrary is available on all good podcast apps and at spybrary.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 220 of the Spybrary podcast. Delighted to bring you another Dead Drop 5. Today we are delighted to chat with Dr. Mark Pack. He is the president of the United Kingdom's Liberal Democrats. I'll add a note to that party for those of you who are not familiar with them in the show notes. He's also the author of Polling Unpacked and he's a huge fan of spy novels. Welcome to Spybrary, Mark.
Lovely to join you. Thank you for making clear the United Kingdom Liberal Democrats, because the Russian Liberal Democrats are a very different party.
Even here in the US, Liberal Democrat is very different from your Liberal Democrat. You're very different from the Free Democrats. I don't know. Anyway, people can go and check that out in the show notes. But it's interesting, we talk a little bit about politics here, because I'm curious to know, why do you think it is that there's so many politicos that either enjoy reading spy fiction or, in fact, writing spy fiction? I was just looking at a copy of a book called Ralph, which was written by John Stonehouse, the former Labour cabinet minister who faked his own death in the 70s. And when he came back, he started writing spy novels. And I think it was Nigel West, who another politico, who said it was the worst spy novel ever written. So I've had that for some time. And of course, our recruiting sergeant here at Spybrary, otherwise known as the Sunday Times chief political commentator, Tim Shipman, is also, as we know from the Tim Shipman list of 125 authors ranked and his own Spybrary, that this is a very long-winded way of saying that lots of you politicians, politicos, like a bit of spy fiction, right?
I guess there's an overlap in the thought that one can pull off brilliant results by really devious plotting, that, you know, you can easily imagine, I don't know, say from the thick of it, some of the characters such as Malcolm Tucker. Imagine he could fit in a Mick Herron novel, couldn't he? You could imagine Mick working that in. And I think there is that sense of manipulating people for a greater good, but it often going wrong, is a sort of bittersweet story that one can tell very often about espionage, but also very often about politics. The thing I find fascinating is that sometimes that sort of manipulation in politics is done in the aid of genuinely noble causes. The classic example would be Lyndon Johnson, who, former US president, who when he was US president used all sorts of devious trickery to get civil liberties legislation through the US political system. And this is, in a sense, the thing that spies often use to justify their dodgy behaviour, is there is a greater cause. So I can see the overlap. And of course, you know, my own party, one of our former leaders, Paddy Ashdown, technically nobody has ever yet officially confirmed he was a spy, but he spent time for working for the Foreign Office in Geneva. Draw your own conclusions.
Yeah, so that's interesting. And in fact, it's funny you mentioned Paddy Ashdown because he also wrote a spy book. I've got a book of his in the other room, Game of Spies, I think it's called, and haven't got to that one yet.
Yeah, he's written one about the resistance to the Nazis, which is a really interesting read. I'd very much recommend it, particularly because you can get the audio version, which is narrated by Paddy, and he has a lovely voice for things like that. But it's one of the great things about audiobooks. I think that we will get to increasingly appreciate in years to come the fact that you can hear a book narrated by somebody who's sadly no longer with us, and therefore you don't get to hear or see in other ways. Imagine in 50 or 100 years' time being able to hear the current generation of spy novels read in often by the author themselves.
So here's a question for you, right? This is unscripted. 100 years from now, what spy novel do you think people will be reading?
Ooh, I think they will be reading the five that I'm about to pick on this episode. I think the five are so clearly the correct list.
I can tell you're a fellow podcaster. I love the segue. Let's get to the meat of this episode, Shane. So I'm curious, what is your first pick? What are you going to ask your handler to stash away for you?
Well, so I had to give this quite a lot of thought because I was thinking, you know, could I sneak in some nonfiction? Because actually, if I can digress before I even get to the first answer, I was really tempted to pick actually Gordon Carrera's nonfiction book, Russians Amongst Us, which is about Russian sleeper agents in the US, because it has the most fascinating detailed tradecraft descriptions I think I've come across in any of the nonfiction espionage books I've read. And in particular, he highlights how there was this big, almost methodological dispute between the relative merits of dead drops versus brush buys, which is the best way of really communicating with you. And you can just imagine them, you know, a bit like PC versus Mac, Android versus Apple. There must have been some huge internal politics in spy agencies at different times over that. So there's so much rich stuff to think about with his book. But I decided I'll be good. I'll stick with novels. And I thought for the first one, really, I just sort of had to pick Robert Littell's The Company, because I think in many ways it captures everything I like about spy novels. So for people who aren't familiar with him, he's got a combination in his background that, again, is common with a lot of spy novelists, of being a former journalist and a former military man. He served briefly in the US Navy. And when he was a journalist, he did things like interview Henry Kissinger and the like. So, you know, you feel like he's got a bit of knowledge, although I don't think there are any stories about him having been a spy himself. But nonetheless, he's got a bit of sort of knowledge of. And The Company is nearly 900 pages. So if I'm restricted to only five books, that's a good one to keep me busy for a long time. And it's essentially a fictionalized history of the CIA. It's also the novel that I think has aged the best of any novel I've ever read. Because, and I'll try and not give any spoilers in saying this in case anyone has not listened to it and might therefore, you know, read it or might therefore be enticed to reading it, is near the end of the book. And a theme all the way through the book is this question about you sort of compromise your morals and your purity to endorse dodgy behavior, hopefully trying to achieve a greater good. And is that justified? Does it come off? And towards the end of the book, it's set in the late 80s, early 90s, the sort of final stages of the book. The CIA are involved in various dodgy dealings to try and defend the nascent democracy, post-communist democracy in the Soviet Union. And you think, well, that's, you know, you can exactly see the dilemma there of clearly helping democracy take off. It's a good thing, but what's the price that you might pay for it? And bear in mind, I'm just checking when the book itself came out.
I believe it was 2002, Mark.
Yeah, 2002. So at the time that he wrote it, the twist he gives at the end is part of the CIA's dodgy dealings is to do a deal with Vladimir Putin, then a relatively obscure Russian figure, in a way that would help save democracy but gave Putin's career a boost. And this obviously, even at the time that he wrote it, was, you know, meant to sort of show that trade-off. But my goodness, given everything we know and everything that has sadly happened since, you know, culminating in the latest invasion of Ukraine, you know, that it makes the bittersweetness of the, do you really want to do a deal with somebody like Putin to help defend democracy? It makes that all the more poignant. So the other thing I love about the book is it's really cleverly, because it's based on historical events, but it's a fictional account, the main characters are all fictional, you basically know what the outcome is of most of the moments of drama. You know the Bear Pigs invasion is going to fail. You know the Russian tanks are going to roll into Hungary and so on. But running through it is this ongoing dispute over whether there was an undiscovered further Russian spy in the CIA nicknamed Sasha. And so that's a real genuine dispute. I'm sure amongst listeners, there will be ardent believers both that Sasha existed and that Sasha didn't exist. And so that's a really clever way of doing something fictionalized and yet still leaving for the reader some real doubt as to whether or not, you know, in this case, the Sasha who's a suspect in the book is going to turn out to be guilty or not. So lots of fun things. Actually, I've just thought of another thing. Another thing I really like about the book. I promise this is the last thing for our pause for breath, which is, I think for my money, it has the closest to a scene that really nails what to my mind, must be one of the most emotionally devastating things about discovering there has been a mole or a traitor in a Secret Service, which is that if you've worked closely or worked underneath someone who turns out to be a mole, when you realise you have that moment of revelation that everything you've done in your career has either been betrayed or thought too insignificant to be worth betraying. And that sense of that everything you've done has either failed or been pointless must be a horrible moment of betrayal. And I think most actually fiction novels that have that sort of moment in it, to my mind, slightly gloss over how soul-destroying it must be to have your whole life up to that point suddenly feel worthless. And I think The Company does the best, I think, and around the fictionalized version of James Justus Angleton, and, you know, from what we know of the real James Justus Angleton, is that it is discovering that Philby, who had been a close friend of his and who he'd probably been indiscreet with over lots of drunken lunches, discovery that Philby had been a Soviet spy was probably what tipped James Justus Angleton into that path of paranoia and all the controversy that flows from that. So yeah, loads of stuff to enjoy about the book itself, but it also does that sparking of thoughts about all sorts of other things to keep your mind churning even when you put down the book after reading the last page.
It's interesting, you mentioned audiobooks a few moments ago, and I actually listened to The Company because it was on my bookshelf, and I'm like, okay, it's like ready to go for a long run. You keep looking at it and say, okay, go psych myself up for it.
I'm very impressed if you can keep running for long enough to listen to the audiobook, because it's a mammoth audiobook, isn't it?
That'll be the goal. Scott Brick narrated it, and Scott's been on Spy Read, a wonderful narrator, and he got into character, you know, different voice for each of those characters. So for me, listening to it, I think it was something like 35 hours. I can't quite remember. That was a long one.
I mean, it's 900 pages, so it must be more than a day's worth.
Wasn't quite as long as listeners, Tim Shipman's All Out War, but that's another, I think that was 40 hours plus. But no, and I grew to love the characters. And I think you're right. Like, you know where it's going. You know about Bay of Pigs in the same way that Day of the Jackal, you know, De Gaulle survives, but you're still really interested in, well, what's going to happen here. And I was actually really sad when the book ended, because I felt like these people had become my friends because I'd spent so long with them.
And I also really like the, again, trying to avoid spoilers in how I phrase this, the ambiguity of the death near the end. To me, reading it, it seems pretty clear what happened, but I know other readers take a different view on this. And I like the fact, again, there are a few clues, and it doesn't feel like he's deliberately playing games with us by leaving something ambiguous. It rather feels like he's told the story as somebody would see it, and we've got the clues, and it's up to us to decide which of the two stories around the death we think is the right one, which I think, again, just makes for a very satisfying ending, I think.
Absolutely. And for me, The Company is a spy book that I would read again. And there's not many that I would have, you know, because doing this job, I don't have a lot of time to reread spy novels, but that is one I could see myself in the future at some point in my rocking chair with a glass of whiskey by the fire when I'm retired, maybe, if I can ever afford to retire and read The Company and many others. So excellent choice. And of course, being 900 pages, just what you want when you're behind the curtain, so to speak, a lot of lonely nights in East Berlin. So what would your second pick be?
So my second is the most straightforward, as it were. It's got to be John le Carré. But I was thinking, you know, as I said, yeah, what makes for a good set of five? Well, with Robert Littell, we've got the volume, the length, the words to keep me busy. With le Carré, as best I can remember, he was my first proper entrance into spy fiction. I say proper to rile up readers, but listeners, by saying I had actually read some Ian Fleming James Bond books before, but we all know James Bond isn't really an undercover spy. So le Carré was my entry into spy fiction. But particularly what I remember is the Richard Burton movie and of the spy who came in from the cold, and Alec Guinness in the, you know, portraying Smiley in the amazing TV adaptation. So oddly, in many ways, my introduction to spy fiction, although it was technically stories written by le Carré, was really as much Richard Burton and Alec Guinness as it was John le Carré. And I always find that fascinating how, because I really like listening to audiobooks as well, how often my experience of a book is so different from the novelist, because in between the novelist and me, is the narrator. And there's another novelist who wrote a series, sadly, he passed away recently, a great series of detective novels called Christopher Fowler. And I listened to them all on audiobook. And I remember once saying to him how brilliant I thought his narrator was for the audiobooks and how lucky he was to have such a great narrator. And it turned out he had never listened to any of the narrations. I used to think how weird it was that for me, Tim Goodman's voice and how he voiced the characters so part of the book. So with me, Le Carré, you know, for me, Smiley is Alec Guinness. And there have been, you know, some other brilliant people, you know, portraying Smiley. And of course, John Le Carré originally wrote the words. But for me, so in a sense, it's as much the memory of Alec Guinness as everything else and Richard Burton that sort of pulls me back to. But in the end, I decided to pick The Spy Who Came In From the Cold because it is just, to me, it's your absolutely classic. If you had to pick one novel to epitomise the whole genre, if we were sending a satellite, a new Voyager satellite, off out of the solar system to meet, you know, aliens somewhere in another star system, which is the novel that we could pick that would capture spy novels in their entirety? For me, it's The Spy Who Came In For the Cold. And actually, partly I say that because I realised, thinking about it before we started recording, how almost identical the opening of it and of Len Deighton's Berlin Game is. The two books start with the same sort of scene. And I even tried, you can even read one of them and substitute the names of the characters from the other. And it makes perfect sense. If you indulge me a moment, I'll just grab my copy of Le Carré. But I will substitute, while I read you the opening of Le Carré's, I will substitute the Len Deighton character, Berlin Game character names. So it would be Werner Volkmann handed Bernard Sampson another cup of coffee and said, "Why don't you go back and sleep? We can ring if he shows up." Sampson said nothing, just stared through the window of the checkpoint along the empty street. That works perfectly as the opener for Berlin Game, but those are the words from The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. But I don't think anyone would sort of knock one for being a pastiche of the other. It's that both in their own ways are that essence of your Cold War spies and traitors, mole hunts fiction. So the other reason for picking The Spy Who Came In From the Cold is that it leads on to my third pick, in that obviously John Le Carré returned to the plot of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold in his later Legacy of Spies. But I think there's another author who, I will say outrageously, did that return to a previous book plot far, far better than John Le Carré, who therefore makes it into my list. Because I think for me, that Le Carré second novel, and maybe this is a little bit unfair on John Le Carré, but was slightly undone by a plot inconsistency. Because when I was reading, so when the Legacy of Spies came out, I thought, well, I'll first reread A Spy Who Came In From the Cold. So I've got all the plot details fresh in my mind to really appreciate how, you know, Legacy revisits the same plot. And because of that, and I think try and remember this right, there's a moment in Legacy of Spies where you discover that Munt first visited the UK sooner than you're told that he did it in The Spy Who Came In For the Cold. And for me, that was a moment of revelation because it was, my goodness, if Munt was in the country then, and therefore that means Smiley's not telling the truth. I mean, surely it's not going to turn out that Smiley was a Russian spy, but maybe Smiley pretended to be a Russian spy at some, you know, there was a whole set of plot excitement that opened up that then sadly came crashing down to earth when I realised it's just a plot inconsistency. So that's maybe a little bit unfair, perhaps, to judge a Legacy of Spies on that basis. But there's another author who did the same trick, but I think much better. So they're my third pick.
Before you move on to pick number three, so it's interesting you said that you would send up to space Spy Coming From the Cold as this is a spy story, but it's probably the book that is least likely that the intelligence services would hand out if they had a recruiting office, because it really doesn't show life working as a spy is particularly glamorous. You know, he's jaded, he's weary, he doesn't think so highly of himself. It's a tough life. Who wants to be a spy after what, as you said, you got James Bond on the one hand, and then you've got Spy Coming From the Cold. Who wants to do that job?
I obviously have no idea of what real spy life is like, but there's a beautiful brief reference in Ben McIntyre's book about Oleg Gordievsky, where you realise there was this member of embassy staff who was checking a dead drop every week, month, whatever it was, for year after year after year after year. And then suddenly on one occasion, and of course, you know, always with fiction, you're boiling down a lot of boredom of real life into a shorter, more interesting story. But it did make me realise how much even of the non-fiction accounts of sort of spy stories and so on are a bit like only knowing test cricket through watching 28 minutes highlights packages. You know, part of the what must be genuine excitement of the job comes from the contrast between the years of boredom and the moment of sudden tension. You know, you've years of checking a dead drop, nothing there. And again, you sort of think in the real world, there must be people who are sort of known for, you know, nicknamed all the way through their career for the bad luck of the person who never found anything. You know, 40 years of checking dead drops, never found anything, you know. And so again, just those little clues it gives us as to what might happen in real life is intriguing. So I suspect in that sense, there probably isn't any book that a wise spy agency would want to use to encourage people, because it will either put you off or it will give you a completely false sense of excitement about the job.
Very true. Very true. So let's move on to pick number three.
So pick number three from the author who is better than John le Carré is Anthony Price. And actually, Anthony Price is partly how I discovered the Spybury community, because he was, in his time, a really successful novelist. His novels basically came out in the 70s and the 80s. And his novels are still in print. They've all subsequently got turned into audiobooks. So in that scale of things, to still be in print and for people to think it's worth the cost of making an audiobook of your books 30 years after the last one came out, that is phenomenally successful. I could only dream of being anywhere close to that. But he's also pretty much forgotten. And it really struck me when John le Carré's A Legacy of Spies came out and that concept of writing a novel years on from a previous novel, but returning to the plot of the previous novel as the events in the original novel get reinvested. That's exactly what Anthony Price did with a pair of his novels. Yet none of the book reviewers, I scrounged to read as many reviews of Legacy of Spies as I could find, and none of them mentioned that Anthony Price had done this. And I thought, poor Mr. Price, you know, that he's so forgotten. I think part of the reason is that he falls into that period of time of people who were really well known just before the internet took off, and therefore have left quite a small online footprint. So there is, I think there's slightly more than one, but a few years ago, there was only one decent interview with him, for example, that you could find online. So even if you are a bit of a fan, you enjoy reading the novel, you go online to find out more, there's not very much more you can find out about him, which is why I was quite excited to stumble on this community where people did know about Anthony Price and did know things about him. And so the novel I've picked is Tomorrow's Ghost, which has two, I think, standout features. I mean, it is your absolutely classic Anthony Price of a very complex plot where, I mean, I find I go back and reread any section of dialogue two or three times because you've got multiple different perspectives and agendas with each person understanding what's going on slightly differently. You can just spend so much time unpacking each conversation in the book. But it also has what I think is the MacGuffin of MacGuffins. It is so brilliantly clever. For listeners who don't know what a MacGuffin is, it's basically something that is central to the plot, but whose own content isn't in itself relevant. So there's an example often used from sort of Alfred Hitchcock movie, but I think the best example is you think of a story like the Sherlock Holmes one about the theft of some naval plans. And you never hear any details about the naval plans. The naval plans don't matter. The story is all about who stole them. How do you discover who stole them? Can you, you know, track them down and so on? And again, without wanting to give away any spoilers, in a way, the MacGuffin in Tomorrow's Ghost is almost like, imagine you read a murder detective novel and it turned out that who was killed, how they were killed and who killed them, you never find out in the novel. And that's, in a sense, what happens in this one. The mystery at the heart of it, you think, surely that's got to be revealed in some way. It remains a mystery all the way through. And yet all the rest of the book works around that. So clever. So brilliant MacGuffin of MacGuffins. And also, it's the setup for Anthony Price's equivalent of Legacy of A Prospect of Vengeance, which he likewise wrote quite a few years later and has some people going back to investigate the circumstances of the death that happens in Tomorrow's Ghost. So a really fun really fun pair of books. And yeah, I would really recommend, I think, you know, anyone who's not tried an anti-Price book, definitely give it a try, because I think he's still, Tim Chipman did put him in his top 20, didn't he, as I recall?
Yes, he did.
Even that was a disgracefully low rating.
I think, you know, you'd probably put him higher because he's a member of the Journalists Union as well. You know, they'd stick together that lot. But you're right, he edited the Oxford Times from 1972 to 1988. So obviously editing and then writing. And you wonder if writing is just a form of escape, writing fiction for him.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a newspaper editor, I would have thought at the end of the day, surely you want to escape from people's words. But he was also an army captain for 2-3 years. I think it was a relatively brief military career. So again, like with several spy novelists, a combination of espionage, you know, the interest in espionage often seems to flow from a mix of journalism and military background. He also, I only had one exchange with him, but seems to have been an absolutely lovely man. I can't remember quite what triggered me to do it, but one day I thought, you know what, I should really write him a fan letter saying how much I'd loved reading his books over the years. So I managed to track down someone who had interviewed him and said, look, if I write you a letter, would you mind passing it on? And I got this lovely reply back from him. Sadly, he died a couple of years after that. So I'm glad I got round to doing that. But again, I think it's something that it's easy to underestimate if you've not never, say, been an author yourself, is actually even for quite successful authors, how rare it is to get any fan mail. So yeah, I always try, if I've really enjoyed a book, to find one way or another of saying something nice to the author, whether it's just, you know, a tweet or writing them a letter, depending. But yeah, Price is definitely highly recommended.
I did the same with Brian Fremantle, Charlie Muthin series author, and he sent me a lovely email back. And you know, he's knocking on in age. And that's the thing, a lot of the spy writers, you know, you mentioned Le Carre, unfortunately we lost Le Carre, and Len Deighton's hanging on in there into his 90s. But you know, that generation of writers, it's hard to bring them on a podcast, have a conversation, because, you know, they're knocking on in years.
Yeah. And I think particularly, you know, Anthony Price falls also into that category of not just sort of slightly predating the internet in a way, and therefore not being as well known as, and there's not nearly as much about him online as there might be. Also, there was a TV adaptation of 3 of his novels were turned into a 6-part TV series, which I've not actually watched myself, but that's partly because the reviews of it are pretty mediocre. And so he never quite hit the really big time in terms of public recognition in the way that a hit TV series obviously can catapult you into ongoing fame. But I mean, the other thing I really like about the Price novels is that, you know, people do die in them, but the violence is very carefully rationed, and therefore it does make the violence that happens particularly shocking in a way that, if you're watching something like a James Bond film or a Mission Impossible film, I mean, just so many people die. I just find, you know, it sort of loses the emotional heft that actually somebody losing their life, to me, you know, should have. So the careful deployment of limited but emotionally quite powerful violence, I think, is done really well in Price's novels.
Yeah, I agree. I like how he uses, it's spy fiction but intertwined with history. So I read the first one on your recommendation, which I think is Labyrinth Makers. And I like that he's weaving that history in with a modern day, or for then a modern day case. It was a different twist on spy writing than I'd experienced before.
Yeah, and there's a real, I think, love of a military history and also of the English countryside. And I think particularly the English countryside, not in that, I think all of the main scenes that come to my mind are sort of in walking across sort of moorland in England rather than in Scotland or Wales. But it just gives you a real sense of novels that are based in somewhere other than the US. And there are lots of great American novelists, lots of great novels based in the US. But I just find in general, across TV, film, literature, it's so easy to end up basically living in a world that's an American world. And so I think novels that are firmly rooted in a different country always, to me, have that little bit of extra appeal as something that little bit different.
What can you tell us about the main character, Dr. David Audley?
He's a fascinating chap. And one of the things he runs through all of the Price novels, and he noticeably ages and changes through them, which I think is a really nice touch. He's also a rather difficult individual who normally gets his own way, but is by no means perfect. And I do wonder if, to what extent, Anthony Price may have, you know, projected some of his own personality onto him, because, you know, he's one of those people who is sufficiently brilliant that the rest of the world has to work out how to put up with his downsides.
Yes.
Which is an indulgence I think we could all love dreaming of.
Absolutely. So, and he was played by Terrence Stamp in the TV series, right? So a big name.
Yeah, and the reviews of Terrence Stamp's performance are not complimentary generally. So, as I said, I've not watched it myself, so I don't know whether that negativity is justified or not. But I do think that making three of the novels into a six-part series, so each getting two episodes, just feels wrong, that I think you need to revel in the complexity and the ambiguity, because so much of the enjoyment is the fact that nobody really knows what's going on and you've got multiple different perspectives and theories. And so you just need the space for that to breathe in a way that I suspect if you were to try to condense it down as they did for the TV series, you just end up with plots that are a bit too boring that not enough happens, because you've squeezed out the space for the doubt and the uncertainty and the confusion, and what you're left with doesn't actually have that much action in it.
Are you on the hunt for your next thrilling spy read? Look no further. Spybury contributor and Sunday Times chief political commentator Tim Shipman has curated a list of his top 125 spy authors ranked. With Tim's vast experience and expertise in politics and spy thrillers, you can trust his judgment on the best spy authors of all time. This list includes both classic and modern writers, making it the ultimate guide for any spy fan. But wait, there's more. Tim also recommends which book to try first from each author, and he shares his favorite book from each of them too, so you can dive right into the best of the best. Ready to get your hands on Tim's list? Head over to spybury.com/top125 to grab your free copy now. Don't miss out on the ultimate spy reading list. Visit spybury.com/top125 today.
It's interesting you mention Tim's list and then your post on the Spybury community. I was aware of Anthony Price, but hadn't read any. So that's another big plus of our community. I've discovered so many writers, and I think Ted Albury is one that I just wasn't aware of when I was growing up. And he's written a lot of spy books. David Brierley, Big Bear, Little Bear, was one of the best spy novels I've ever read. And he's on community, and I think he's well into his 80s. And it was great to chat to him on this podcast.
Oh, that must be so lovely for the fact that there is such a group of fans now of Big Bear, Little Bear. You know, the way it keeps on cropping up with people saying, oh, and now I've read it as well. For him, that must be so lovely that there's been this extra little burst of love and affection for his book. But actually, that will bring us neatly to the next author, because my next author I had not heard of at all until the Spybury community pointed them my way, because I was thinking that I'd sort of gone for three novels by men, and the fifth one is a novel by a man. I thought I should just push myself a bit and see if, mate, you know, is there a novel by a woman that I could include? And maybe just explain that a little bit, because I guess sometimes you see that in the Spybury Facebook group when issues around sort of gender balance and so on come up, that people sometimes say we should just concentrate on the best. And one of the things I've learned from politics is that actually, if you're, say, got five candidates and they're all men, even if you think you're getting the best, actually the chances are, if you force yourself to try and find a woman, you will actually end up with a better overall mix. That the best and the most obvious who most readily come to mind are not the same. And so I thought, let's make myself work a bit harder. Think about, can I find a film? So I had a look at Tim Chipman's list, and my first attempt was a bit of a failure, I'll confess. So I tried Sarah Gainham's book, The Cold Dark Night, and I thought this is going to be great because Sarah Gainham comes up high on Tim's list. So clearly, you know, major mark in her favour. And one of the characters in the book is a really unpleasant chap who is closely based on her divorced first husband. So again, you think, oh, well, this is quite fun. That extra little spice reading about that. And it's based around a conference in Berlin. So it's got your classic Berlin backdrop, but also journalists feature heavily in it. And the fact that Tim thought it was a good account of journalists made me think, oh, well, this will be really interesting, because quite interested in journalism as well. However, it just did not work for me. And I counted it. There are 8 characters introduced in the first 4 pages, and most of them are journalists. I felt like I was on the back foot from page 2. I was struggling. So it is really good, very evocative picture of Berlin that it paints. But for me, it was just undone by, at one point, a dead body is found, and then the people who find it abandon it to go and eat dinner instead, in a way that it just didn't work for me. And I sort of, all the way through to the end, I sort of had at the back of my mind, is there some twist? But the other thing that actually struck me, which was I was quite surprised by, because clearly Sarah Gainham was a pioneering female espionage novelist, very successful in her own right, so clearly very admirable person and knew what she was about. I don't know what else she got up to in her life. Maybe one has to caveat that about other things, but certainly in terms of as an author, really impressive. And yet the depiction of women in the book is really sexist. And again, I did a bit of a double take. I thought, look, am I just being unfair here? And so I went back and looked at what's the first thing you get told about each of the characters, each of the many, many, many characters you get introduced to. And it's really striking how with men, you'll get straight into some dialogue, and with women, you'll get some description of their body parts. And I thought, this is really, and obviously, given how successful she was as a pioneering female author, I mean, I don't know, maybe actually that just reflects how she saw things. Maybe her editor, as it were, made her do that, as it were. Or maybe she knew she was writing for a predominantly male audience, and, you know, in the 50s and 60s in particular, felt that that was what she had to write. But I was quite surprised. If I'd not known who the author was, I would have assumed the author of the novel was a man. So anyway, having failed with Sarah Gainham and her novel, I then tried for Helen McInnes. And I think I hit gold dust with this. Really enjoyed. I read her first novel, which is Above Suspicion. And so that's definitely my pick. And it's almost like an Alfred Hitchcock sort of plot turned into novel form, because it's basically two innocents, man and a woman, two innocents abroad, bumbling around as amateurs, saving the world, meeting mysterious strangers on dramatic train journeys, traveling around Europe. You know, it really feels like it could be a Hitchcock movie. But again, it has a few other angles to it that really caught my eye. So it was published in 1941, whilst the Second World War was on, but is quite complimentary about quite a few Germans. It definitely draws a distinction between good Germans and Nazis. And that's the sort of thing that's very much a feature of 50s and 60s fiction, war movies, especially your classic sort of war movies that would be on Sunday on ITV on a bank holiday weekend back when there were only 3 or 4 TV channels, you know. And part of that I had always thought was almost the political necessity after the Second World War of saying, well, if we're going to have any form of West German government, any form of West German military, you almost have to somehow create this idea of good Germans separate from Nazi. But I was really struck how strongly that comes through, even in a novel published during the Second World War. It's also just, I think, cracking good plot. It's a relatively straightforward plot. You know, you've got the two characters, you basically follow them all the way through. There are some good twists and turns along the way, but given a bit of added spice by the fact that her husband worked for MI6, and you sort of say, you feel like, well, maybe some of the detail, you know, is maybe has got, and certainly one of her later novels, well, in fact, two of her other novels, Assignment in Brittany, was apparently used as a manual to help train spies. And one of her others had so much detail about the Polish underground that there were lots of rumors that maybe her husband had passed her some genuine information that she made use of in it. So that always gives it a bit of extra spice, I think, if there's a bit of overlap between the real world and a novel. And the brilliant thing about her novel is it's also available as an audiobook. And I think all of her novels are in print and available. So I fear that many months of the rest of my lives are now going to be handed over to Helen McInnes. I need a new journalist, a new author to be my fun, you know, how do I indulge myself at Christmas? For many years, I read a new Philip K. Dick novel each Christmas. So I need a new author to fill that gap. So I think Helen may well fill that gap.
Yeah, and another female author I can recommend is I.S. Berry, Sparrow and the Peacock. Peacock and Sparrow. I'll get it right one day. I think what I like about her book was if I wasn't in communication with her for coming on the podcast, I wouldn't have known what the gender was of the author.
Yeah, I didn't realise that she is a woman until I saw the photo that went with the podcast that you did with her. And I thought, oh, that's... Yeah,
absolutely. So I recommend her book. I think you'll enjoy it. Just from the pics you've made here, you know, on the spectrum of action towards more realistic, she's definitely more on the more realistic side of the aisle, shall we say.
The other, I guess, particularly notable female novelist, of course, is Stella Rimington, with her background as being an actual spy chief. And I've read one of her novels, which I quite enjoyed. And again, I think there's some, her reference to the mentality of people whose job it is to shoot other people. And that there's a really interesting scene there where she just describes the look of on the faces of the people who are wielding the guns, which I thought I can imagine was, you know, brought in a bit of reality and just what it actually means to have a job where you might have to kill someone. I think very powerfully. But I must admit, the rest of it, I mean, it was a very good novel, vastly yeah. better written than anything I've ever written, but it didn't quite do it for me in terms of hitting the top five list.
Yeah, but it sounds like with Helen McInnes, you're going to go and read back catalogue and enjoy yourself, because she was quite prolific, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And really intrigued. I've not yet read the one that was apparently used to train spies, so really intrigued.
And that's the one I hear referenced most when people refer to her work as Assignment in Brittany. So I think that's the classic to go for.
And sadly, I think she's also suffered a little bit from unsuccessful adaptations, hasn't she? Because there was, in the 1940s, 43, I think it was, there was a movie of one of her books, which has decent reviews and so on. But subsequently, there were two post-war movies, which have really bad reviews. I nearly watched one of them about a week ago. But I was then sort of reading some online reviews, and I read one which basically said, look, I decided to ignore all the online reviews and figured, because it's a Helen McInnes book, this film must be worth watching. Don't make the mistake I did. It really wasn't worth watching. So that put me off watching it. And certainly the trailer for it was not brilliant, for the Salzburg Connection, I think is its name. So I think she suffered a bit from not having had a really good sort of film or TV adaptation. But she's in print. People have turned them into audiobooks. Again, that's pretty impressive going. And I'm looking forward to years and years of working through her back catalogue now.
Brilliant. Talking about TV and movie adaptations, did you ever see the TV adaptation of The Company?
No, I haven't. Because that is Stanley Kubrick, isn't it, who directed it? Or at least he was lined up originally to direct it. But I've tried to get it on DVD, but not managed to track it down at a sensible price yet.
I've watched half of it, because I think I downloaded it from Amazon Prime, and I kept it for my long flights back home to the UK. And again, the reason I bring it up is I'd read very mixed reviews on it, and I thought, well, I'll give it a go, and I enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty well done.
One of the TV adaptations, actually, which I don't think is based on a novel, and sort of, you know, was moderately successful, was ITV's The Game.
Yes.
From a few years back, which is very... It's very atmospheric, with one exception. I don't know if you spotted, Shane, there was one scene where they didn't change the bus stop painted sign on the road. If you're, say, not from Britain and were watching it, there's nothing about that that would stand out. But if you are, you would know that those painted bus stops on the road, it's relatively recent. And it's really weird. They've done all of this other huge amounts of effort to make it really feel like it's in the 70s, except they didn't CGI out the bus stop painted on the road, or indeed paint over it, you know, while filming, and then put the signage back afterwards. So, but very atmospheric in a way that the film adaptation of Smiley's People, again, is brilliantly atmospheric. I know there are some people who have not read the novel who say they enjoyed the film version. I must admit, it puzzles me how you can follow and enjoy the plot if you've not read the book first, but it definitely is really atmospheric, really nicely done.
Yeah, if you search The Game in the spybrary community, it's a huge hit among most of our spybrarians. And people are saying, why wasn't there more like this? Why wasn't there another series? Why wasn't it more created?
I must have joined subsequent to most of those discussions, the community. But yeah, it's really enjoyable. Definitely recommend that as a little side bonus alongside the five novels.
Yes, and you'll notice it often comes up in a thread as well, where people will lovingly refer back to The Game. And I know we're starting soon a TV track on Spybury and movie track, so we'll cover a lot of these.
Oh, brilliant. I'll be able to get wax lyrical about the dustbin in the Smiley's People film then. For those people who haven't seen that scene, there's one beautiful scene where you just see the outside of the house briefly, and it feels so of the time. And one of the little touches they've done to get it right is you've got this corrugated metal dustbin, which is of a style that used to be really common, now has pretty much disappeared. And it's just at the edge of the shot, but it just gives you that immediate sense of, oh, I recognise that. This takes me back to the right decade. Very, very smart.
Very clever. Yeah, we will definitely start those TV series roundtables soon. What's your next pick, Mark?
My final pick is back to Robert Littell. And I've picked The Defection of A.J. Le Winter, which is actually his second novel, but it's the one that really made his name. And the thing that I love about it is the plotting is so clever that it's the story of Mr. A.J. Le Winter, who defects from the US to the Russians. And it tells you the story of both sides investigating the defection, because the US are investigating why did he defect, and the Russians are investigating is he a genuine defector. But of course, if he was a plant, the US would be investigating anyway for show to make it look like he was genuine in case there was another Russian spy. So the fact that you hear both sides of the story at the same time still leaves you in doubt as to whether he was a genuine defector or not. So it's a really clever constructed plot. It also does what, say, Len Deighton does in his trilogy of trilogies with Bernard Sampson so nicely, of you've got particular facts or events which are open to multiple interpretations. And so you can argue over, well, because X happened, does that mean this is true or does that mean that's true? And so that sense of multiple incompatible bits of evidence and three bits of evidence point one way, two point another way, another four are ambiguous, and you could argue either way, what on earth am I meant to make of this on balance all in all? Really, really cleverly done. It also pulls off, I think, what is perhaps the hardest thing in a novel that has got some element of tension or drama about it, which is that you know how far through the book you are. And so you know when you're on the penultimate page. And that, I think, makes it really difficult for a novelist, because it's like when you're reading an Agatha Christie, you know the first suspect is not going to be the one who done it. And you know there's at least one more death coming because you're only on page 27 and you've got the rest, And so the way that the final scene, as you start reading it, could be a scene from the middle of the book. It could be there's another 200 pages to go, And yet the final line, the final payoff, is a satisfying ending to the book. Whilst also, it's not like you know that earlier things are not going to be clear. It just fits so beautifully. The only other sort of novel I can think of that pulls that off so well, at the start of the last page, it doesn't feel like it's the last page of the book, but you don't know how it's going to end. And the way it ends feels natural and not rushed. And also the way there's a twist, but it flows naturally from the rest of the book. So it doesn't feel like you've had a fast one pulled on your last moment. There's actually another spy novel, Graham Greene's The Human Factor.
Oh, yeah.
Which I was tempted to pick partly because of my love of chocolate and the way Maltesers feature in The Human Factor as this luxury chocolate of the time. It's quite fun. And Graham Greene pulls off a similar thing. When you get to that last page and that last conversation, there could be another 50-100 pages, but no, he wraps it up so appositely and in a way that means he sidestepped the problems of you knowing how far through the book you are. So really, I mean, there are a couple of things about Defection of A.J. Le Winter that I guess have probably not aged that well. I know there's a newer edition, which I've not had a chance to actually check, because I suspect there are one or two bits of vocabulary that might have got tweaked in a more recent publication. And it is very much of the world where when there's a moment of stress, men drink whiskey and women have to take sedatives. That definitely is a little bit sort of dated in that respect. But fundamentally, it's just a really clever piece of plotting that I absolutely love. And certainly if anyone, loves that interwoven stories that you get in Len Deighton's trilogy of trilogies, I think you'll enjoy. It's quite a slim novel, but as a much shorter fix of the same fun.
Yeah, I'm going to have to kick that up my TBR list, because I recently bought Littell's Young Philby and I was going to get onto that. But now I'm really intrigued by The Defection of A.J. Le Winter. And that came out in 1973, I believe. So right in the middle of the Cold War.
Yeah, and it's even, again, trying to phrase this in a way that doesn't give any plot spoilers, but you can imagine if we had both read it, there's a scene early in the book where some people in the US are arguing over different bits of evidence and contradictory indications from them. Even when we've both finished the book, we could go back and argue over who is right in that discussion. It's very clever, I think, the way it gives you a sense of how, even when the truth is very firmly established in real life, there often are bits of evidence that don't quite fit or a bit ambiguous, which is sadly often the fuel of, say, conspiracy theories, you know, that it's pretty rare for everything to perfectly neatly line up. And of course, in the espionage world, if everything neatly lines up, you need to be suspicious that someone's not pulling a fast one on you, because surely it can't be all that neat. So it plays with that, I think, really, really cleverly. It's the sort of thing that if it were turned into a TV series with multiple parts, you'd have a great set of arguments and discussions online after each episode as to what's really happening, who's right, who's wrong.
Brilliant. Well, there's some very intriguing picks, as I knew you would deliver on the show today. And there's a few there that I haven't read, so I'm intrigued to go look them up, especially the Robert Littell defection of A.J. Leventer. I think they're going to kick that up the list. Now, as well as books, you're able to ask your handler for some various items to make your stay in East Berlin a wee bit more comfortable. One of those is a piece of music or a CD or a record. What would you like to take with you? What would you like to be stashed away for?
I'm not really musical or into music, although weirdly, I did a podcast a while ago about my favourite albums, which was you know, I did warn the person doing it, look, are you sure you want me on? But it was quite fun. But one of the songs I picked for that, which I think I will pick for this, is The Beautiful South's Carry On Regardless. And partly because it's a fun song, I love the song, the music video that went with it is a great music video. But also because I think I fundamentally have a different take on the lyrics from the intended take. So it's intended as a sort of bitter lament about people's stupidity and they just carry on regardless. But I actually read into the lyrics a sense of great optimism about how persistence can pay off. So I quite like it from that point of view. So yeah, that would be Carry On Regardless is my tip. And if anyone has enjoyed the song, but you know, that your mind is a blank about the music video, well worth hunting it out on YouTube or elsewhere, because it involves an elephant for some bizarre reason, but it's a really fun music video.
We'll try and add a link to that in the show notes. What about booze? What about some alcohol? What would you like stashed away for you?
For me, it's caffeine-free Pepsi Max. I'm not a great alcohol drinker, but I drink far more caffeine-free Pepsi Max than I should do. So that's definitely. And I think, you know, in the communist era, that was definitely would have been a Western luxury. I hope that can count as equivalent to.
They had their own version of Coca-Cola, but from what I hear from my friends who grew up in the former GDR, it wasn't great.
So there's also, or was at least, a Polish Pola Cola. That's right, which I remember before going to a quiz night, I picked up a big bottle of Pola Cola from a local supermarket. This was in London. It wasn't, you know, I was in Warsaw or something. And the rest of the quiz team were not pleased with me because it did not taste the best. You know, could you not have brought something better? You know, this is. So, yeah, if you ever see some Pola Cola, avoid would be my.
Avoid it. What about a luxury item? Anything you'd like to have stashed away?
I mean, I mentioned my sort of love of Len Deighton. I've not picked a Len Deighton novel. So I am rather cheekily, because I think at least one of your previous guests has gone for a similar luxury, but I'm going to pick an iPad classic click wheel, because they were just beautifully designed, loaded to the gunnels with audio versions of Len Deighton novels, in particular his trilogy of trilogies and Winter as well. So I could gorge on them endlessly, because they are the sort of novels that, because of the interrelated nature of the plots, you sort of want to be able to savour again and again. And once you've got to the end, as it were, you can start again at the beginning and enjoy all the more the cleverness of so much of what he did. And the click wheel was just a brilliant invention of, here is a lovely way of being able to move around stuff on a small electronic device. So yeah, an iPad click wheel stuffed full of Len Deighton.
Yeah, that's a great selection. I was looking at my copy of Berlin Game the other day and I thought, oh, and I wouldn't mind a reread. And I thought, if I do that, I'm going to read all 10, because I will not be able to just read the one. And I don't have time to read 10, as I am at some point.
And now, of course, if you do that, you're going to have to read that and The Spy Who Came In From the Cold in parallel to see at what point the,
exactly.
The scene breaks down.
Well, I want to read the whole Smiley series in one go as well and just enjoy it as a series with the Legacy of Spies at the end.
And actually, it's the second one in the trilogy, isn't it? The one set in Hong Kong, which, for understandable reasons, got skipped in the BBC TV adaptation. And It seems like the film version is probably not going to appear as a sequel to the relatively recent film as well. And I guess it's understandable because it's so firmly set in Hong Kong that it would be hard to film without being able to do stuff on site, and therefore all of the extra cost and so on that comes from that. But the backtracing elements of that plot of trying to work backwards as to what might have been betrayed, but what you can figure out the other side knows from what has been betrayed. Again, there's some really clever, ingenious plotting around the backtracing sections, which is, you know, really enjoyable if that's the sort of plotting that you like.
Absolutely. You can call upon any spy, either from the real world or in fiction, to exfiltrate you if needed. Who are you going to call, Mark?
Well, you see, the question is, do I want to pick a spy who's actually going to be successful or a spy that I would really like to talk to?
Well, yeah, I tell you what, I'll give you both options. Why don't we do that?
Because for safety's sake, one has to pick James Bond, obviously, because he always saves the day, except for the one novel, you know, where his wife sadly dies. But other than that, he always saves the day. So James Bond for sort of safety's sake. But I think, yeah, in terms of who I would most like to talk with, I think it would have to be David Audley from the Anthony Price novels, because of the way he ages through the books. And the way I sort of first, I guess, read the first one sort of when I was a teenager and then worked through them, that he sort of aged with me as, you know, there are different periods of your life when getting older doesn't feel like it makes that much difference. But then other periods where absolutely 5 years one way or another makes a really big difference. So given that in a way I sort of grew up with him, it would be quite fun to be able to. And he would, well, actually, I don't know, would Audley actually get me to safety? I fear that he might pull some trick for the attempted greater good that may result in me being the poignant death in the novel. So definitely James Bond if I actually want to live.
Well, I love the David Audley discussion. Maybe we should post that up when this episode is aired on our Spybury community, which everyone can find at spybury.com/community. And it'd be interesting to have that discussion. Will David Audley get you out of East Berlin? If you could only grab one of these books, which one would you grab?
Probably it would have to be The Company, just because it's the longest and therefore the maximum volume of entertainment from it. Although the cleverness of the plotting in A.J. Le Winter and the ambiguity around the evidence and so on would give me plenty of material. But I think on balance, because also the other thing about The Company is because it runs through so much of history, of, you know, genuine history, is it's not a bad basic history of the Cold War either. So I think it would be The Company I would pick. But I don't know, should it not be an Anthony Price? And how can none of them be Len Deighton? But that's the problem with the five. That's the problem with only having five, isn't it?
It is. Someone said the other day, or maybe you should do Dead Drop 3 and you can go deeper into all of the books. I was like, are you kidding? Five is hard enough as it is.
Oh, three. Oh no, who would I axe to get down to three? Please don't do that. Please don't do that.
I will not. And the final question for you is, who would you like to hear next on Dead Drop 5?
It would be mean of me to pick a dead person, because that would be a little hard for you to pull off. Although Anthony Price would be fascinating, given as a newspaper editor, he will have also overseen all sorts of book reviews over the years. So his insights would have been absolutely fascinating. But I believe Robert Littell is still with us, isn't he? He was certainly alive when I last looked. And I think given his own life, you know, including, as I think I mentioned, as a journalist, getting gigs like interviewing Henry Kissinger, I think Littell's insight, and in particular, I wonder what he fundamentally thinks about the CIA, whether he thinks the CIA is a net force for good or not, because I think in his novels, it's pretty unclear. But I think there isn't quite the sort of the anger about the CIA failures that I think I would expect to come through if that was fundamentally his view. But, you know, you by no means would read some of his novels and come away and think everything they do is wonderful. So I think he would be quite a fascinating character. I also think that as an American who has spent much of his life living in France, he's got quite an interesting international perspective on things as well. He also has some fantastic stories that I've read in interviews with him, including a great story about Errol Flynn. So if you were able to tease that story out of him again, I'm sure he could tell it himself far better than I could retell it. So I won't give any spoilers for what he says.
Excellent. Well, if anyone listening here knows Robert's agent or next door neighbor or anyone who knows him, Get in touch with us at Spybury, and we'd love to have him on the show. Well, Dr. Mark Pack, thoroughly enjoyed talking to you about your favorite spy books.
Great fun, thank you.
Been a lot of fun. Thank you for coming on. I appreciate, you know, you're very busy in what you do. And I know there's a lot of Spybarians out there now that are either cheering your selections or heading to their local bookshop to see if they can track it down. So thank you very much for joining us.
I feel I should apologize to anyone who I've added books to your to-read list, because I know how deadening that can feel. Oh no, that sounded so great, but I've already got too many. So apologies to anyone who's now wondering how they can get more hours in their day to do more reading. But it's been really enjoyable. Thank you for making me sit down and reread some books. I really enjoy doing that, Shane.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Spybrary podcast. You don't have to wait for the next episode. Join the conversation happening now at facebook.com/spybrary and on Twitter @spybrary.